Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 8, Discourse Number 1.
Bhagwan, everything arises and passes away. When you see this, you are above sorrow. This is the shining way. Existence is sorrow. Understand and go beyond sorrow. This is the way of brightness. Existence is illusion. Understand, go beyond. This is the way of clarity. You are strong, you are young, it is time to arise. So arise, lest through irresolution and idleness you lose the way. Master your words, master your thoughts. Never allow your body to do harm. Follow these three roads with purity, and you will find yourself upon the one way, the way of wisdom. Sit in the world, sit in the dark. Sit in meditation, sit in light. Choose your seat, let wisdom grow. Cut down the forest, not the tree, for out of the forest comes danger. Cut down the forest, fell desire, and set yourself free.
The way of Gautama the Buddha is the way of intelligence, understanding, awareness, meditation. It is not the way of belief. It is the way of seeing the truth itself. Belief simply covers up your ignorance. It does not deliver you from ignorance. Belief is a deception you play upon yourself. It is not transformation. And the people who think themselves religious are only believers, not religious. They have no clarity, no understanding, no insight into the nature of things. They don't know what they are doing. They don't know what they are thinking. They are simply repeating conventions, traditions, dead words is spoken long, long ago. They cannot be certain whether those words are true or not. Nobody can be certain unless one realizes oneself. There is only one certainty in existence, and that is your own realization, your own seeing. Unless that happens, don't become contented. Remain discontented. Discontentment is divine. Contentment through beliefs is stupid. It is through divine discontent that one grows. But it is the path which is arduous. The path of belief is simple, convenient, comfortable. You need not do anything. You have only to say yes to the authorities. The authorities of the church, of the state. You have simply to be a slave to people who are in power. But to follow the path of Buddha, one has to be a rebel. Rebellion is its essential taste. It is only for the rebellious spirit. But only rebellious people have spirits. Only they have souls. Others are hollow, empty. These sutras of today are of immense beauty, truth. Meditate over them. The first sutra, everything arises and passes away. When you see this, you are above sorrow. This is the shining way. Life is a flux. Nothing abides. Still we are such fools, we go on clinging. If change is the nature of life, then clinging is stupidity. Because your clinging is not going to change the law of life. Your clinging is going only to make you miserable. Things are bound to change. Whether you cling or not does not matter. If you cling, you become miserable. You cling and they change. You feel frustrated. If you don't cling, they still change. But then there is no frustration. Because you are perfectly aware that they are bound to change. This is how things are. This is the suchness of life. Remember Haldane's law, that the universe is not only queerer than we imagine, it is queerer than we can imagine. And remember, you are not alone. The world really is like this. It is a very strange world. Everything is momentary. Yet, every momentary thing gives you the illusion of being permanent. Everything is just a soap bubble, shining beautifully in the sun rays, maybe surrounded by a rainbow, a beautiful aura of light. But a soap bubble is a soap bubble. Any moment and it will be gone, and gone forever. But for the moment, it can deceive you. And the strangest thing is that thousands of times you have been deceived, yet you don't become aware. Again, another soap bubble, and you will believe. Your unintelligence seems to be unlimited. How many times you need to be hammered? How many times your dreams have to be crushed and shattered? How many times life has to prove that clinging is nonsense? Stop clinging, and then you go beyond sorrow. It is clinging that is the root cause of sorrow. The world is dominated by two types of people. Those who understand what they do not manage, and those who manage what they do not understand. Just watch your own life and you will see it happening within your mind too. You understand things which you don't manage. It is easy to understand things which you don't manage. Somebody asked George Bernard Shaw, "Do you believe that nothing is impossible?" Bernard Shaw is reported to have said, "Yes, I do believe that nothing is impossible provided somebody else is going to do it." It is easy to understand what you don't manage. What you manage, you don't understand at all. Do you understand your life? You understand about God, and you don't understand about your life energy. You understand about heaven and hell. There are people who know how many heavens there are and how many hells. One man came to me and he said that in our religion we believe that there are 14 heavens. Mahavira has reached only up to the 5th. Buddha up to the 6th. Jesus, Muhammad, etc. only up to the 4th. Kabir, Nanak up to the 7th. And my guru, the man said, he belonged to the Radha Swami sect. My guru has reached to the 14th. I said to man, "Yes, I know. I have seen him in the 14th. Because I have reached to the 15th. I am acquainted with the guy." He said, "15th? But in our scriptures there are only 14 heavens, not 15th. I said, "How can you in your scriptures be there 15th? Because your teacher has reached only up to the 14th. 14th people. But they go on knowing how many heavens there are and how many hells there are. Jainas believe in 7 hells. They have thrown Krishna to the 7th because he was the cause of the great war, Mahabharata. He persuaded Arjuna, his disciple, to fight and kill people. He was the cause of great violence, so he has thrown him to the 7th, to the last. But in days of Mahavira, one of the disciples of Mahavira, Makhli Gosal, revolted against the masters and declared that there are not 7 hells but 700. People go on talking nonsense, 7 and 700. and they are not aware about their own inner life, from where this breath comes, to where this breath goes in. They are not aware to the closest truth of their being, and they go on talking about ultimate things. These talks about ultimate things are simply to avoid real problems of life. These are strategies of the mind to keep you occupied with utter nonsense. Beware of the mind and its cunning ways. Buddha says, everything arises and passes away. When you see this, he is not saying believe this. He is not saying that I have become the enlightened one, so whatsoever I say, you have to believe in it. He is not saying, because the scriptures are in my favor, so you have to believe me. He is not saying, because I can prove logically, so you have to believe in me. See the beauty of the man. He says, when you see this, you are above sorrow. In that very moment when you have seen this, that everything is momentary, and everything is a flux, and everything is bound to change, do whatsoever you want to do, but nothing is going to become permanent in this life. When you have seen this by your own eyes, when you have understood it by your own intelligence, suddenly you are beyond sorrow. What happens? A great revolution happens in that seeing. That very seeing is the revolution. Then you don't cling. The moment you see that this is a soap bubble, you don't cling to it. In fact, clinging to it will force it to burst sooner. If you don't cling to it, it may remain there dancing in the wind for a while. The non-clinger can enjoy life. The clinger cannot enjoy life. Gussie had lived a good life, having been married 4 times. Now she stood before the pearly gates. Father Abraham said to her, I notice that you first married a banker, then an actor, next a rabbi, and lastly an undertaker. What kind of a system is that? For a respectable Jewish woman. A very good system, replied Gussie. 1 for the money, 2 for the show, 3 to make ready, and 4 to go. If you see, you can enjoy, then it is just a game. Then everything is totally different. Then it is a big drama. Then the whole earth becomes just a stage. And everybody is acting his part. But if you don't see, you become obsessed. You start clinging to things. And deep down you know that they are slipping out of your hands. I had everything a man could want, moaned a sad-eyed friend of ours. Money, a handsome home, the love of a beautiful and wealthy woman. Then, bang, one morning my wife walked in. you can't remain in the same state for long. Life changes just like the dreams. Hence the mystics have been calling life nothing but a dream. A dream seen with open eyes. A dream shared by others too. In the night, the dream is private. Nobody can share it. In the day, the dream is public. Everybody can share it. In the night, the dream is subjective. In the day, the dream is objective. But the quality of both is the same. Writings on water. You have not even finished writing and they start disappearing. Not even writings on the sand, because on the sand the writing may stay a little longer. It will have to wait for the wind to come or somebody to walk over it. It is writing in water. You go on writing and it goes on disappearing. Seeing it, you are above sorrow. Immediately, then nothing else has to be done. The moment you have seen it, where is sorrow? The cause has disappeared. You have removed the very cause. You cling and you create the cause. Non-clinging is liberation. Hence Buddha says this is the shining way. So simple, so luminous, that unless you are utterly blind, spiritually blind, you can't miss it. He is not talking about great metaphysical truths. He is not philosophizing. He is not using complex words and systems and theories. He is simply stating a fact that he has seen. And you can see it. It has nothing to do with Buddha. It is not his invention. It is not his idea. It is the facticity of life. Look around. Everything is changing. It is like a river moving and moving. And you want to catch hold of it. It is mercury. If you try to catch hold of it, you will lose sooner than before. Don't try to catch hold of it. Watch joyfully, silently. Witness the game, the dream. And you are above sorrow. Buddha is not saying you will go beyond sorrow. He says you are above sorrow. Existence is sorrow. Understand and go beyond sorrow. This is the way of brightness. Existence is sorrow. First he says, sorrow arises out of clinging with momentary things which you cannot make permanent. It is not in the nature of things. It is against the universal law. It is against Dhammo. It is against Tao. You cannot win. If you fight with the universal law, you are fighting a losing battle. You will simply waste your energies. And what is going to happen is bound to happen. Nothing can be done about it. All that you can do is about your consciousness. You can change your vision. You can see things in a different light, with a different context, in a new space. But you cannot change things. If you think of the world as very real, you will suffer. If you see the world as a strange dream, you will not suffer. If you think in terms of static entities, you will suffer. If you think in terms of nouns, you will suffer. But if you think in terms of verbs, you will not suffer. Nouns don't exist. They exist only in languages. In reality, there are no nouns. Everything is a verb, because everything is changing and everything is in a process. It is never static. It is always dynamic. The second thing Buddha says is, existence is sorrow, to be is sorrow. The ego is sorrow. First he says, see the world as dream, fluctuating, changing, moment to moment, new. Enjoy its newness, enjoy all the surprises that it brings. It is beautiful that it is changing. Nothing is wrong about it. Just don't cling it. Why you cling? You cling because you have another fallacy, that you are. The first fallacy is that things are static. And then the second fallacy is that you are, that you have a static ego. They both go together. If you want to cling, you need a clinger. If you have no need to cling, there is no need for a clinger. Go deep into it. If you don't need to cling, the ego is not needed at all. It will be pointless. In fact, it cannot exist without clinging. The dancer can exist only if he dances. If the dance disappears, where is the dancer? The singer exists only in singing. The walker exists only in walking. So is the ego. The ego exists only in clinging, in possessing things, in dominating things. When there is no domination, no desire to dominate, no desire to cling, no desire to possess, the ego starts evaporating. On the outside you stop clinging, and in the inside a new clarity starts arising. The ego with all its smoke disappears. The ego with all its clouds disappears. It can't exist because it cannot be nourished anymore. For it to exist, it has to cling. It has to create my and mine. And it goes on creating my and mine. In every possible and impossible things, the ego says, this is my country, as if you have brought it with your birth. As if the earth is really divided into countries. The earth is undivided. It is one. But the ego says, this is my country. And not only that, this is my country. This is the greatest country in the world. This is the holiest land. Ask the Indians. This is the most spiritual country in the world. Everybody else is materialist and we are spiritualists. And everybody else has his own ideas. They are great. Ask the Germans. Nobody is of pure blood. Only they are. Aryan blood, Nordic blood, purest blood. God has created them to rule the whole world. And ask the Japanese. They have descended from the god Sun directly. They are not ordinary mortals. The sun is their source. And the sun is the source of all life. And you ask anybody, everybody has his own ideas, how his country is great, how his religion is great. Religion also becomes your position, my religion, my Christianity, my Hinduism. Who can claim religion? Who can claim that religion is a position? You can be religious, but you cannot claim that Christianity is yours. You cannot claim that Hinduism is yours. But the ego is so stupid. It goes on claiming all kinds of things. Mr. Ginsberg came home one day from the garment district where he owned a company and said that he must get a mistress. Why? Guessed Mrs. Ginsberg. Well, replied her husband, all the owners have them and it looks bad for my business that I don't. Well, if it is for business, all right, said Mrs. Ginsberg. Sometime later, Mr. and Mrs. Ginsberg were enjoying an evening at the opera when suddenly Mr. Ginsberg said, look, Miriam, there is Mr. Pincus and his mistress sitting across from us in a box. Mrs. Ginsberg studied the pair for a long time with her opera glasses and then said, ours is better. Anything and everything will be claimed by the ego. And ours is always better, whatsoever it is. The ego exists only through such claims. The I exists only as an island in the ocean of my and mine. If you stop claiming things as my and mine, the ego will disappear on its own accord. Neither the wife is yours, nor the husband, nor the children. All belongs to the whole. Your claim is foolish. We come empty-handed into the world, and we go empty-handed from the world. But nobody wants to know the truth. It hurts. Empty-handed we come, and empty-handed we go. One starts feeling sick. One starts feeling scared. One wants to be full, not empty. It is better to be full of anything, any garbage, than to be empty. Emptiness looks like death. And we don't want the truth. Our whole effort is to live in convenience. Even if that convenience is based on illusions. I demand an explanation and I want the truth, shouted the irate husband upon discovering his wife in bed with his best friend. Make up your mind, George. She calmly replied, you can't have both. Either you can have the explanation or the truth. And people are more interested in the explanation than in the truth. Hence so many philosophies. They are all explanations. Explanations to explain away things. Not to give you the truth. Explanations to create great smoke so you need not see the truth. And Buddha's insistence is see it. Because without seeing it, you can't go above sorrow. James to his wife, I am in the mood and you are so beautiful. Catherine, what makes you think I am beautiful? James, when I am in the mood, everybody is beautiful. The whole question is of your mood. If you are in the mood of an ego trip, then you will not listen to Buddhas. Or you will listen in such a way that you can manage, distort, interpret those truths according to yourself to support you. If you are still interested in the ego, you can't understand these sutras. If you have become fed up with the ego, if you are tired of its games, if you have seen that it brings only suffering and nothing else, then these truths are so simple to understand that in fact no explanation is needed. And I am not explaining them to you. I am simply hammering them on your head. From this side and from that side, you try to dodge. You try to escape. You try to close your eyes. But I go on shouting in your ears, hoping that sooner or later you will be able to understand. Because without this understanding happening to you, your life will be a nightmare. And many lives you have wasted in nightmares. It is time to wake up. Existence is sorrow. Understand and go beyond sorrow. This is the way of brightness. Buddha says this is the way of intelligence. This is not for dull, unintelligent, mediocre minds. The way of the Buddha is for those who are intelligent. And who is not intelligent? If you decide to be intelligent, you are intelligent. You are born with great intelligence, but you keep it repressed. You are afraid of your own intelligence, because your own intelligence will disturb your settled routine of life. Somehow you have managed to settle, and your own intelligence will keep you moving forward. It will go on telling you, this is not the truth. Again you have fallen a victim of a dream. Move on. Unless you reach the truth, there is no way to rest in peace. Move on. Because intelligence goads you to move on, we repress it. Everybody is born intelligent. I have never come across a child who is not intelligent. But it is very rarely later on to find intelligent people. What happens in the meantime? Every child turns to be stupid later on. By the time you come from the university, you are fully established in your stupidities. The university is a guarantee. That now you are intelligence proof. Nobody can make you intelligent again. They have sealed you. Socrates says, know thyself. Buddha also says, know thyself. And both have been misunderstood. Socrates more than Buddha. When Socrates says, know thyself, people think there is someone inside who has to be known. There is nobody inside. When Socrates says, know thyself, he is simply saying, go in and see what is there. He is not saying that there is someone that you will come to know. He is simply saying, go in. But he does not make you so much scared. Buddha says clearly that there is no one. Go in and see. There is only seeing, but not a seer. There is understanding, but nobody who understands. Knowing, but not a knower. This has to be understood. This is Buddha's very emphatic message. That there are processes, certainly, but there is no center to those processes. Yes, there is love, but no lover. And there is meditation, but no meditator. And there is liberation, but nobody is liberated. It looks very strange. But now modern science agrees with it. As far as objective reality is concerned, modern science agrees with Buddha more than with anybody else. Hence, Buddha has a great future. Because science will come closer and closer every day to Buddha. Science is going to speak in the same language as Buddha. Science says there is energy but no matter. That's what Buddha is saying for the inner world. There is energy, movement, processes, but no entity, no ego. Know thyself means know that you are not. Great courage is needed to know this. People want to know that they are immortal souls. Then they are very happy that we are immortal souls. And Buddha says, don't talk nonsense. You are simply not. Immortality is there, but you are not immortal. When you disappear completely, whatsoever is left behind, that cleanliness, that purity, that innocence, that nobodiness, that nothingness, that sunya, that is immortal. It has no beginning and no end, no birth and no death. But rather than going in and finding the basic illusion of the ego, rather than going in and finding the root cause of all your misery, you go on throwing the responsibility on others. Murphy's famous maxim: the man who can smile when things go wrong has thought of someone he can blame it on. Everybody is trying to blame his misery on somebody else. And that's how we remain in misery. Because this blaming is not going to help. In the first place, it is wrong. Nobody else is the cause of your misery. The cause is within you. You are living with a fallacy. But even if you are living with a fallacy, the mind enjoys the idea that somebody else is responsible. I am not responsible. You feel a relief. Doctors, you have got to do something about my husband. What seems to be the problem? He is convinced that he is a refrigerator. That's terrible. You are telling me, snapped the wife, he sleeps with his mouth open and the light keeps me awake all night. A woman called a psychiatrist on the phone and cried, "Doctor, you have got to help me. My husband is driving me crazy. He keeps insisting that he is Moses." "That sounds serious," replied the psychiatrist. "I think you should bring him to my office tomorrow." I will," she replied. "But in the meantime, how do I keep him from parting the water every time I try to take a bath?" Even if you are mad, the mind would like to believe that somebody else is responsible. Somebody else is mad. People are ready to believe that the whole world is mad, but not they. In fact, a madman never accepts that he is mad. You can go to a madhouse and you can ask all mad people. And you will be surprised. Not a single mad person will agree that he is mad. The whole world is mad. He is perfectly sane. In fact, those who understand mad people, they say that once a madman accepts that he is mad, he is no more mad. Sanity has already started coming into his being. That's what all the Buddhas have been saying. The moment you understand that I am ignorant, the first glimpse of knowing has happened. The moment you say that I am not, for the first time, real existence has penetrated you. The first time you say that I don't possess anything, the whole world is yours. The first time you say that I am not separate, that I am one with the whole, you become the whole. The dew drops does not really disappear, it becomes the ocean. By knowing one's emptiness, one's egolessness, one loses nothing, one gains all. And the third sutra, existence is illusion. Understand, go beyond. This is the way of clarity. Buddha does not give you doctrines. He does not give you dogmas. He is not a bit interested in giving you philosophies of life. His whole concern is one: how to make your mind clear, how to impart clarity to you, so that you can see unhindered, so your eyes no more carry any dust, so your eyes are without dust, and you can see through and through as things are. Ordinarily, whatsoever you see is your projection. That's what you call existence. You project. The existence functions only as a screen, and the projector is inside you, and you go on projecting your desires, your imaginations, your hopes, your dreams, and you go on seeing things which are not there. People go on to the very end, projecting. Even if you meet them after their death, you will find them into the same mess. Business had been terrible for Blum, and he cut down on his help. In a month he had to cut down still further, and everyone said that this terrible strain became a fixation that hastened his death a few weeks afterwards. As they were carrying his body down the aisle of the chapel, Blum suddenly sat up in the coffin and asked, "How many men are carrying me?" "There are 8 pallbearers, Mr. Blum," said the undertaker. "Better lay off too," said Blum, lying down again. Even after death, the old obsession continues. And don't take it as a joke. This is how things are. People go on believing in the same things after death, They go on continuing the same desires. That's how they go on coming back again and again to the earth to fulfill the same unfulfilled desires. And those desires are unfulfillable. So they go on coming again and again, millions of times. Buddha calls it a vicious circle, a wheel which goes on moving. You are just like a spoke in the wheel. Sometimes up you come and sometimes down you go, but the wheel goes on moving up and down, life and death, one moment of success, another moment of failure, one moment of hope, another moment of despair. And it goes on, and it has been going on for eternity. And this whole thing is your own projection. This is not reality. Reality can only be known when you have nothing to project. That state of non-projection, Buddha calls clarity. Clarity means you have no desire. You don't want things to be in a certain way. You are ready to see as they are. You are simply a mirror, not a projector. When you are a mirror, this is samadhi. This is satori. You simply reflect like a silent, clear, cool water of a lake reflects the full moon and the stars. When you are absolutely clear, no dreams, no desires, no imaginations, no memories, the whole mind put aside, the mind is a mechanism to project, then there is clarity and things are reflected as they are. And for the first time you know what is the case? Otherwise, existence is illusion. Understand this, that whatsoever you think as existence is illusion. Understand it and go beyond. This is the way of clarity. You are strong, you are young. It is time to arise. So arise. Lest through irresolution and idleness you lose the way. In ancient India, when Buddha was delivering these sutras to his disciples, this was the accepted tradition that a man should become a seeker only in the last stage of his life. If you assume life to be of 100 years span, then the Hindu idea is to divide life in 4 parts of 25 years each. The first 25 years are for education, brahmacharya. You go to the university, you live with masters to learn the skills of the world, the arts, the craft, the science. And after 25 years you come back into the world, you get married. And for 25 years now, the second stage, you live as a householder, as a husband, as a father, fulfilling the duties of life. And then comes the third stage. 25 years again, you prepare to renounce the world. The third stage is called vanaprastha. First is brahmacharya, celibacy. so that you can devote your whole mind into your studies. No distractions. Your whole sexual energies have to be concentrated in studies. Then the second stage is called garhastha, the stage of the householders. You devote your whole energies into the family life, make a house, create a big business, earn money, raise children. And then the third is called vanaprastha. Vanaprastha means facing towards the forest. Now prepare yourself to leave the world. Prepare for 25 years. Live still in the house, but turn towards the forest. Slowly, slowly, disconnect yourself. Go on giving your responsibilities to your children who will be now coming back from the university. And the fourth stage, after 75 years, the last 25 years, you become a sannyasi. This was the routine, accepted, conventional thing in India. In the first place, people don't live 100 years. And particularly in those days, not at all. All the scientific research that has gone into proves that people in Buddha's time lived at the most average 40 years. 40 years were the average life. And it does not seem too bad, because even now in India, 36 years is average life. With all new medicine, medical help, hospitals, if India has only 36 years as average age, then in those days, with no science, with no medical facilities, if people lived 40 years average, they were doing perfectly well. So people were not living 100 years. By the time one was 75, one was gone. So for the majority of the people, the time for sannyas will never come. It seems it was just an effort to postpone it. And even if somebody lived after 75, few people lived. Buddha himself lived for 80 years. If few people lived after 75, their life will be almost without energy. They will be dead, walking corpses. They won't have energy enough to meditate, to rise to the highest peaks of consciousness. They will not be able to transform their beings into Buddhahood. That will be impossible for them. Buddha brought a great revolution, and India has never forgiven him for that. He destroyed the whole nonsense idea of stages. It is nonsense, because there are intelligent people who can be sannyasins even while they are young, and there are few super intelligent people who can be sannyasins even when they are small children. Shankaracharya became a sannyasin when he was only 9 years of age. Buddha became a sannyasin when he was 29 years. So it is foolish to postpone it. And why go on postponing truth to the very end, when you will be almost a corpse, no energy left, and then you will try to soar high into the sky? When the days have come to go into the grave, you will try to take a flight towards the sun? It is impossible. Buddha was the first in India to introduce the idea of a young sannyasi. His emphasis was that youth is the best time to be a sannyasi, because it is great energy that will be needed for the inner transformation, for inner work. It can't be postponed. And who knows about the future? Who knows about even the tomorrow? Or even about the next moment? He says, you are young, you are strong, then this is the time. It is time to arise. Don't postpone. There is no need to postpone. Don't say that I will wake up only after 75 years of age. And one person who has been dreaming for 75 years will find it very difficult to wake up. After 75 years of dreaming, dreaming would have become almost a second nature to him. As you grow old, you become more and more stubborn, less and less flexible. As you grow old, you become more and more mechanical, less and less alive. Your ways of life become so settled, your ways of thinking become so fixated, that it becomes impossible to change them. That's why it is so difficult for an old man to learn any new thing. They say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Children learn very easily. Old men find it very difficult to learn, because they already think they know. Their whole life's experience is there. And their life's experience starts dominating them. It goes on dominating them to the very end. Zeb and his wife Edi had a reputation for being the stingiest couple in the hills. Zeb died a few years back, and his skin was downright embarrassed about the way Eddie took on about the cost of the funeral. She even insisted on having the coffin closed, so she could not have to pay the undertaker for a room to hold the viewing. A few years later, Eddie got sick, and it looked like she was going to meet Zeb in the hereafter. Eddie called her only friend to her side and made her promise to see to the funeral. "Promise you will bury me in my black silk dress," she said weakly. "But you may as well cut the material out of the back of the skirt. It is good material, and it surely is a sin to waste it." "Now, Eddie," replied her friend, "I just could not. When you and Zeb walk through those pearly gates, You surely don't want to go with no back to your dress. Don't give it another thought, replied Eddie. They will all be looking at Zeb anyway. Why do you say that? Because I buried him without his pants. The whole life, if you are miserly, even in death, you will be the same. As you grow old, you become more and more settled. Youth is the best time for inner transformation, because youth is the most flexible time. Children are more flexible than young people, but they are not so understanding. They need a little experience. Youth is exactly the middle. You are no more a child, no more ignorant of life and its ways, and not yet settled as an old man. You are in a state of transition. And the state of transition is the best time while you can jump out of the wheel of life and death. The youth is the most significant time to take any jump, because the jump needs courage. It needs energy. It needs risk. It needs daring. Buddha says, you are strong, you are young. It is time to arise. To be youth, to be young, to be fresh is a great benediction. It is the time of rebellion. And if you miss your youth, it will be more and more difficult later on. Not that it is impossible. It can happen even when you are old, but it will take more arduous efforts, and things will not be so easy. It is just like climbing a mountain. When you are young, it is easier. When you become old, it becomes difficult. Breathing is hard. Rising up is tiring. You perspire. You feel exhausted very soon. You will need more rest. And the journey will look very long. When you are young, you can run up. You can run up to the peak. And each step will release more energy in you. Because to be young is to be a reservoir of energy. Many people come to me and ask why I am giving sannyas to young people. Because of this, youth is the time for sannyas. Because sannyas is the greatest rebellion. No other rebellion is so great. Don't waste your youthfulness into other ordinary revolutions, political, social, economic. Don't waste your life energy into those stupid games. Put your total energy, focus your total energy on a single point, the spiritual revolution, because that is a radical change. And other changes can follow that change. If your inner being changes, your whole outer life will be totally different. It will have a different fragrance, a different beauty, a different grace. And when your inner being is changed and becomes a flame of light, you will become a light unto others too. You will become a beaconing light, a great herald of a new dawn. Your very presence will trigger revolutions into other people's lives. Buddha says, so arise, don't waste a single moment, lest through irresolution and idleness you lose the way. The only danger is irresolution. A life uncommitted, uninvolved, is not worth calling life. It is only through commitment, involvement, that your life attains sharpness. Your intelligence becomes a sword. Through idleness, you gather rust. Your sharpness disappears. You become old even while you are young. And if you remain sharp and you remain rebellious, even when you are old, you will not be old. Only physically you will be old, but your inner being will remain young. And that is one of the greatest experiences of life, when your body becomes old, but your inner being keeps its youthfulness. That means you have not lost track of life, that you are keeping yourself in step with life. You are not left behind. You are not lagging behind. The Buddha says, master your words. He says, ordinarily a mind is full of words, relevant, irrelevant, rubbish. All kinds of words go on gathering inside you. Two persons are talking, you simply hear, and those words become part of your mind. For no other reason, accidentally, you heard two persons talking. You have become burdened. You go and you read the signboards, and those words become part of your being. You need unnecessary advertisements. In magazines, people read advertisements more than anything else. Or you go on gossiping with people, knowing perfectly well that this is just useless, a sheer wastage of time and energy. But words are gathering inside you like dust, layers upon layers, and your mirror will be covered by them. Buddha says, master your words. Be telegraphic. Listen only to that which is significant. Read only that which is meaningful. Avoid the unnecessary, the irrelevant. Speak only that which is to the point. Make your each word your heart. Don't just go on saying things as if you are a gramophone record. Mary was sitting alone on the coach when her mother came in and turned on the light. Why? What is the matter, dear? Asked her mother. Why are you sitting here in the dark? Did you and John have a fight? I know, nothing like that, replied Mary. As a matter of fact, John asked me to marry him. Well, then why do you look so sad? Ah, mother, it is just that I don't know if I could marry an advertising executive. But what is wrong with marrying a man who is in advertising? Well, how would you feel if a man who was proposing to you told you that it was a once-in-a-lifetime, never-to-be-repeated, special offer? Just like a gramophone record. He may not be at all aware what he is saying. Maybe repeating his habits. He is skillful in that. It has become part of his mind. It may be repeating itself. He may not be conscious at all what he is doing. When Buddha says, master your words, he means be conscious. Why you are saying something? Whom? And what is the purpose of it? Be clear. Otherwise, be silent. It is better not to burden others with your garbage. If you can enlighten, good. If you can unburden, good. Otherwise, it is better to be quiet. Master your thoughts. Any thought goes on inside your mind. Watch for a few minutes and you will be surprised. The mind seems to be crazy. It jumps from one thought to another thought for no reason at all. Just a dog starts barking in the neighborhood and your mind takes the clue from it. And you remember a dog that you used to have in your childhood, and the dog died. And you start feeling sad. And because of the death of the dog, you start thinking about death and the death of your mother and the death of your father. And you become angry because you were never at ease with your mother. There was always conflict. The dog is still barking, completely unaware what he has done. And you have traveled so far. Anything can trigger a process in you. This is a kind of a slavery. You are at the mercy of accidents. This is not mastery. And a sannyasin, a seeker, should be a master. He thinks only if he wants to think. If he does not want to think, he simply puts his mind off. He knows how to put it on and how to put it off. You don't know how to put it on, you don't know how to put it off. It goes on and on. It starts working in the childhood and goes on working till you die. 70 years, 80 years, continuously working. So much work, and then you cannot expect anything great out of it, because it is utterly tired. It has not much energy left. It is leaking from everywhere. If you can put it off, That's what meditation is all about, putting the mind off. The art of putting the mind off. If you can put it off, it will gather energy. If for few hours every day you are without the mind, you will gather so much energy that that energy will keep you young, fresh, creative. That energy will allow you to see reality, the beauty of the existence, the joy of life, the celebration. But for that you need energy. And your mind has only very little energy. Just somehow you manage your life. You live a poor life for the sheer reason that you don't know how to accumulate your mind energy, how to make a reservoir of your inner being. It goes on and on leaking, and you don't know how to stop those leakages. Never allow your body to do harm. Three things Buddha says: be careful about words, be master of your thoughts, never allow your body to do harm. Because the body comes from the animals. The body is animal. It enjoys harming. It is violent. Be conscious of it. Don't allow it to go into violence. Don't allow it to harm anybody. Because if you harm others, the harm will come back to you sooner or later. That's the whole theory of karma. Whatsoever you do to others will be done to you. So do to others only that which you would like to be done to you. Follow these three roads with purity, and you will find yourself upon the one way, the way of wisdom. The last advice Buddha gives is that don't follow these three paths out of calculation. Follow them innocently, in a childlike way, exploring, inquiring. Make it an adventure, but don't be calculative. Don't be businesslike. We are all businesslike. And that is one of the basic reasons why we go on missing the joy of life. A businessman can never know what joy is. He is always thinking about profits. People come to me and they ask, if we meditate, what will be the profit out of it? What we are going to gain out of it? If I say to them that meditate for meditation's sake, they look puzzled. They say, then what is the point? They can't understand that few things in life should be done not for any calculation. Love for love's sake, art for art's sake, meditation for meditation's sake. All that is beautiful and great can never be reduced into a means to something else. And the businessman knows only that. The business-like mind always reduces everything into a means to some end. And these are ends. Meditation is an end unto itself, not a means to anything else. Hence, be childlike, innocent, non-calculative, be pure, and you will find yourself upon the one way, the only one way, the true way, the way of wisdom. Sit in the world, sit in the dark. These words are tremendously pregnant. Sit in the world, sit in the dark, sit in meditation, sit in light, choose your seat, let wisdom grow. Sitting in the world means to be in the mind. And sitting in meditation means to be in the no mind. To be in the mind is to be in dark, and to be in the no mind is to be in light. If you have understood the previous sutras, you will know how to be a no mind. And then there is light and only light. You are flooded with light. You become luminous. And that's how wisdom grows. Cut down the forest, not the tree, for out of the forest comes danger. Cut out the forest means cut out the root, the very source of it all. Not the tree, because the tree is only a symptom. If you cut one tree, another tree will be growing. Don't fight with the symptoms. Look into the root and destroy the root. The root is the ego. The root is the desire of the ego. The root is the clinging of the ego. Cut the whole forest, the ego, the desire, the clinging, the cunningness, the cleverness, the calculativeness, the politicalness, cut all these. Don't go on fighting with small things. Somebody comes and says, how I can get rid of anger? Now, without getting rid of ego, you cannot get rid of anger. And if you try, you will be only repressing it. People come to me and they ask, how we can get rid of sexuality? You cannot get rid of sexuality. If you don't get rid of the ego and its continuous hankering for more and more. You can't get rid of sexuality if you cannot see the inner nothingness. In that seeing, sexuality is transformed into spirituality. Go to the root, to the source. But people go on pruning the trees, thinking that this is how they are going to transform their life. Yes, they can become more sophisticated, more cultured, more civilized, on the surface more polished. But this will be only the surface. Deep down they will remain the same person, as ugly as before, or even more ugly, because all that is repressed will make them more and more perverted. Cut down the forest, fell desire, and set yourself free. If you want to cut out the forest, fell desire. See the point that desire is futile. Live in the moment And don't try to live in the future. Nobody can live in the future. How can you live in the future which is not yet? And desire gives you the illusion of living in the future. Sitting and you start thinking you have become the president of a country. And you start living a dream, a daydream, thinking that you have found great money. A lottery has opened in your name. And you start thinking and become very much disturbed, really disturbed. What to do with it? I had a friend, a doctor, and he was very much obsessed with crossword puzzles. And every month he will fill the crossword puzzles, and every month he will hope that this time he is going to get 5 lakh rupees, 10 lakh rupees. And I have been watching it for years. And the month will pass and nothing will happen, and he will start preparing for another crossword puzzle. One day I was sitting in his dispensary and I told him, "Look, you don't seem to have a great fate." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I have been watching you for so many days, for so many years, and nothing happens. Join hands with me, and this month you will get 10 lakh rupees." He was ecstatic. He said, "Why didn't you say it before?" I said, "But there is a condition. The library of this city needs 5 lakh rupees. You will have to give 5 lakh rupees to the library. Then I can join hands with you. Then my fate will be with your fate. And you know my fate." And he said, "That I know." But he said, "5 lakhs is too much." He started bargaining. Nothing has happened yet. But he was so much disturbed, he started bargaining. 5 lakhs is too much. And I am a poor doctor, and you know. And how difficult it is. And what great competition is there. 20 doctors in this small town. And I am the poorest. And you are demanding 5 lakh rupees. Make it 1 lakh. I said, "Okay." So it is agreed. 1 lakh I will get for the library, 9 lakhs you get. He said, "Yes." But he said yes in such a sad way. 1 lakh rupees. Just going like that. 12 o'clock in the night he knocked on my door. It was summer and I was sleeping on the terrace. So I asked from the terrace, "What is the matter? Who is there?" He said, "I am your friend." I could not sleep. I had to come. 1 lakh is too much. This time, just 50,000. Next month, we join hands again. And then I will give 1 lakh. I said, "Okay. Because I don't want to disturb my sleep, you go away. 50 lakhs is okay. But now don't change it." And next morning he changed it again. He said, "You know my situation. This time let me keep it, the whole amount, next month, whatsoever you say, I will give to the library. I said, then I withdraw my hands. It is, then you do on your own. The month passed, nothing happened. He came to me and he was crying, just tears. And he said, I am such a fool. I would have agreed with you. You were only asking 50,000 rupees. But I did not agree. This month I am going to agree. I said, but now I am not going to do this business at all. Because I know it will happen again the same way. Great bargaining, and your nights will be disturbed, and you will disturb my sleep. You do it on your own. People, even in imagination, start living. You watch yourself. Desire keeps you occupied into the non-existential and goes on destroying that which is present. And the present is the only life. Now and here is the only life. Live it in totality. Live it with your whole being. Put your mind aside and jump into the now with no mind. And all blessings of God will sovereign you. Enough for today.